Hi, this is Megan Francis, and you're listening to the Kitchen Hour podcast. I'm here to keep you company while you get dinner on the table and help you set aside more time for family, food, and fun. Hi, and welcome to the Kitchen Hour. I'm here with Gretchen Rubin, who is author of the New York Times best-selling book, The Happiness Project, as well as a new book, Happier at Home. Nice to have you on, Gretchen.
Oh, I'm very happy to be talking to you.
So, Gretchen, I actually wanted to ask you this before, and I should have checked this out before we got on the phone, but how many weeks was The Happiness Project on the New York Times bestseller list, and is it still?
It is still. It's 78 weeks.
Wow.
Last time I checked.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, it's hanging on.
That's great. Well, it's a fantastic book, and you know, I'm sure listeners probably know this, but there's also a blog, and it's happiness-project.com. And so today, you know, I love that you wrote a book about being happier at home. I think that a lot of times people kind of think about happiness as sort of this outer thing, like that they have to go out and find. And I was reading, I think it was in maybe an introduction of Happier at Home, when you were talking about all the books that have been kind of about people taking these quests and going out into the world to try to like find happiness, and how you kind of wanted to find it within the four walls of your house. And I just love that.
Yeah. I mean, I love reading those kind of radical, exotic happiness projects where people really do something huge, like, you know, Elizabeth Gilbert going to Italy and Indonesia and India, or Thoreau moving to Walden Pond, or I just read Wild by Cheryl Strayed, and she did this huge hiking trip. But I'm really a homebody, and anyway, I don't love adventure, I have to admit. And also just the reality of my life is that I can't just up and do something,
right?
Like a 2-week meditation retreat or something like that. And so I really had to find things that I could do as part of my ordinary day, which was fine because that's the kind of person that I am anyway. That's the kind of project that appeals to me, and mm-hmm. it's also the kind of project that I can actually do. So that was good.
And I love that because, you know, I love to read those books too, and it's very easy to start living vicariously through them a little bit. And then I thought, well, you know, but that's not my reality. I need to know how to find more happiness at the grocery store, or, you know, at parent-teacher conference, or whatever it is that I'm doing in my real life. And that is my real life. And I also like that you mentioned that you don't like adventure. I think it's cool that you're, because I do, in theory, I haven't really decided yet whether I, in reality, like big adventures or not. But I think it's great that you would admit that, because I think that there's a lot of sort of cultural stock put into wanting to live these big adventurous lives. And the quiet life is also very satisfying.
Well, it's one of the things that I realized about happiness is there's kind of a sadness to happiness, because it's really, to live a happy life, you really have to live a life that reflects your own nature, your own temperament, your own values. You really, and the closer I've come to a life that reflects that, the happier I get. But it can be sad, because then you sort of have to admit everything that you really are and everything that you're really not. And
right.
In a lot of ways, you know, we wish that we were different. Or, you know, I wish that I loved to travel and I loved adventure, and I wish that I loved music, and I wish that I loved outdoor sports, and I wish that I loved cooking, and I wish that, you know, there's so many things that I can see why people love to fly fish, and I think it seems so great, and yet I don't really want to do it. And,
right.
And so sometimes it can be a little disheartening to think about what's really true about you and what really does make you happy.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that it's once you acknowledge that and really make it the centerpiece of your life that you become happier. Because if you sort of imagine that you like to travel a lot, but you don't really, then there's not going to be a good fit between your idea of yourself and the reality of yourself, at least for me.
No, I totally agree. And I think that you're right that there is sadness, because not only, like you said, are you putting aside sort of this image you had of yourself, but you can be sad about not getting to do the things that you don't even really want to do.
Exactly. My mother-in-law said that, like sort of in those words, she's like, why is it that I feel bad that I don't want to do something, even though I really want to be home reading a book? And yet you feel this kind of sadness that you're not about what you're not.
Right.
Or not doing something, even though you don't want to. I mean, I wrote about this on my blog. It was funny. And I said something like, I had to admit that I wasn't the kind of person who wanted to go to jazz clubs at midnight. And somebody wrote on the blog, they're like, but Gretchen, you live in New York City. You could go to jazz clubs at midnight. And I was like, yes, I could go, but right. I don't want to. And that's what makes me sad. I wish right. that I wanted to go to a jazz club at midnight, but I don't want to. And that's the thing. You know, you just see all the things that you wish you could be or you wish you could appreciate. You know, the world offers all these things that you don't even take advantage of or appreciate because they're just not part of what makes you happy. And so I do feel like there's something that's a little bit poignant about that.
And I think the fact that you live in a big city gives you maybe the chance to figure things out for yourself that maybe people living in places where they don't have that option wouldn't figure out. And I lived in Chicago for about a year and a half, and I learned a lot about myself then because it was like I literally could do anything I wanted to. Mm-hmm. And before we moved there, we lived in this little town, which again, now we live in a little town, kind of telling that we moved back to a little town. But I'd be like, oh man, you know, we're going to live in Chicago. It's going to be awesome. We can do anything. We can go to any any kind of restaurant, any kind of museum. And you know, the life that we lived there was pretty similar to the one we live here, except a lot more expensive. So it's just, it's kind of interesting. That was a year where I was like, gosh, maybe I'm just not the person I thought I was. And it is very telling. And it's, and also I sometimes wonder about seasons of life or that kind of thing, because like when I do go on vacation or travel, I do enjoy doing things like that, but I wouldn't want that to be necessarily my weekly existence or like a regular thing. It's the novelty, I think, that makes it fun.
No, and I think that's exactly right. Like the kind of things that you want sometimes aren't the things that you would want for your everyday reality.
Right.
And so I think you're right. It's good to know, like, well, what do I like to do as a special treat? And what do I really want to be part of my regular life?
Right.
And so, yeah. And so there are those sort of different, and you're right about the seasons of life too. There are things that maybe you would do a lot. Like a friend of mine said, she used to go to lectures all the time. That's the kind of thing you can do in New York City. You know, she'd go to this lecture and that lecture. Mm-hmm. And then she had kids and she's like, I haven't been to a lecture in 10 years. You know, but then the time will come when she'll go to lectures again because all the kids will be grown. So part of it is also appreciating a time of life and enjoying what you have while you have it. Not always thinking like, I should be doing this, I should be doing that, when it's not realistic. And just feeling like, well, right now I'm going to enjoy what my life is, at least for me, that was a big part of my happiness project, is like really appreciating what life is like right now and not being so distracted and absent-minded that I didn't even notice.
Right.
It's fleeting. And then it'll be another season of life and there'll be other things to appreciate. So
giving something up for now doesn't mean giving it up forever. It just means, you know, I'm not into that right now. And
Yeah.
I wanted to talk about your book. So your book covers an academic year, correct? It goes September through May. Yeah. And it's the new book, Happier at Home. And it's broken up into themes. And so like, you know, October is marriage and November is parenthood, etc. But I really wanted to talk about your January chapter first, which is time. And, you know, that's one of the things that I thought it was funny earlier. You mentioned that you don't like to cook, and I'm here. We are like on a show that's about being in the kitchen. But the funny thing is, I don't really love cooking either. So for me, that's kind of beside the point. It's more like we need to eat. I want to set aside time for my family at night. And this is a way to do it. Right. And so I feel like it really ties in with your chapter about time.
Yeah.
And so some of the things, like one of the things that you say in your chapter, you talked about, or one of your philosophies, I guess, was to guard your children's free time. And I would love to hear a little bit about how that plays out for you. I know you live in a city where I can imagine the pressure to be doing a lot is even more intense than it is other places in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, and I have to say, this is something that I struggle with all the time, which is, you know, how much do you as a parent sort of interfere with your children's natural proclivities? Because on the one hand, we want them to give things a try and have fun, you know, not just like sit around the house all day and you know, experiment and all that. And it seems like a good thing to do. But then on the other hand, you just sort of have to let people figure out what they want to do. Mm-hmm. And it's really struck me as an adult. I'm fascinated when you can see in adult an adult satisfaction with career, the roots of it in their childhood play. Mm-hmm. And what's striking is that often that connection is not obvious. I mean, it wasn't obvious at the time. You know, like it's easy if you're like, you've got a kid who's like, you know, like drawing architectural plans, perhaps that, oh, maybe this kid will be an architect.
Right.
But sometimes it's more attenuated. And like my sister is a television writer. And she said to me in all seriousness, I just wish I'd watched more television as a child when I had the time. And, you know what I mean? So something that to us is sort of like the paradigmatic waste of childhood, right, to her is actually super important and enriching and, you know, and actually significant to her career. And so, but so I'm always caught in that, like wanting my children to do something that like, seems obviously like worthwhile.
Right.
And then also just wanting to stay out of their hair and let them do what they want. With the idea that if they have to figure out what they want to do, that's the best way to figure out, well, what kind of person are you and what do you like to do? Because left to their own devices, people do very, very different things. Everybody right. kind of thinks that everybody does the same stuff for fun, but it's just really not true. And the only way you find out what you like to do for fun is if you have time to do it. And if you're too overscheduled, then you never have any time where you're just messing around. So I do feel like as a parent, I'm caught between, I say that I guard my children's freedom and I try
to guard
people's freedom, but I do sometimes find myself saying like just the other day to my 7-year-old, I was like, don't you want to do an after school class of hip hop right. dancing? I think you want it, you know, really kind of yeah. trying to nudge her into giving things a try.
I love that you mentioned the differences in childhood, how they play out when you're an adult, and also the external pressures that we have to kind of make our kids not do the things that we all have decided culturally are a waste of time.
Yes.
So, you know, like video games, and that for me maybe is a little more intensified in our house because I have 4 boys. And I think that the stereotype that boys are more into video games holds true, at least in my experience. So here I've got these 2 boys who are older and 2 that are younger. And my oldest is 14. He'll be 15 this fall. And my second oldest son is 12. He'll be 13 this month. And they both like video games. And they both have had the same opportunity to play video games. But the differences between the way they do that is it's huge. So like my oldest son, even though I've never really pushed him a lot, I've never signed him up for a lot of activities, that kind of thing, he is the kid who is gone all the time. He would always rather be out doing something. And when he does play video games, it's a very social thing to connect with his friends in real life. So they get on, you know, they get on the Xbox together
right.
via satellite or whatever, and they play. Now, my second son is very much a homebody. And sometimes, like this summer, I realized like 2 months into the summer that he hadn't left the house in like weeks. he hadn't gone anywhere. And I was like, and so then, the pressure comes on like, you know, shouldn't I be pushing him?
Yeah.
Shouldn't I be kicking him out the door? But he's happy. That's where, I mean, that is what makes him happy, is to be home, just kind of hanging around. Sometimes he's on games, sometimes he's reading, sometimes he's watching TV or whatever. So it's like, you know, as much as I want him to try things, at what cost? And I don't want to try to make him be somebody he's not. So it's kind of that delicate balance, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's hard. I mean,
yeah.
There's some part of you that's like, you got to be outside in the sunshine, you know. And then I don't know. I think it's hard, and probably, you know, probably good parents just sort of, you know, muddle their way through, and you don't
right.
do much damage one way or the other.
Right.
But I feel like with parenting, it's good to have a philosophy. Like if you kind of know why you're doing what you're doing, then you feel much more confident in your strategy. Whether or not it makes any difference, but if you sort of can't make up your mind and you're tortured all the time about, I don't know, should we do it? Should we not do it? And for me, once I sort of said like, I really want to respect what my children actually want to do, it sort of took a lot of pressure off of me to feel like I needed to badger them all the time to do stuff.
Right, because then you're doing it for a reason. It's not like you're just like, well, whatever, I give up. It's more
right,
like,
right.
yeah.
Exactly. You've got it. I was like, yes, I'm not doing this out of neglectful parenting.
Right,
I'm doing this
right.
out of a high-minded, philosophical, yeah, but like sort of on the same lines, I remember when my older daughter was young and the whole thing came up about clothes. And I knew that my mother-in-law would really prefer that my daughter wear kind of classic children's clothes. And actually, I prefer those kind of clothes myself. But my daughter was, you know, you can imagine what like a
right.
5-year-old loves to wear all the time. And I find, you know, and I just decided in my own mind, I was like, you know, as long as it's age appropriate and it's not expensive, or, you know, it's like, you know, she can wear what she wants. I'm not going to fight that fight over right. the clothes. And it just made me feel better. And then when my mother-in-law was sort of dropping hints that she didn't like it, that was fine. Because I'm like, I understand where you're coming from, totally, because I agree aesthetically. But this is not a fight that I'm interested in fighting. And I basically feel like a little kid should be able to wear what they want, you know, within mm-hmm. reason. And then I just felt better about it. Because I was acting from a point of view. Like, I had decided what my value was and why I had decided this. It wasn't like I was giving into one person or the other, or I just felt more at peace with the decision that I made.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it's so funny that when you talk about these things that are like, I hear from lots of moms, especially of little girls, about the clothing battles and something like that. That's, you know, it's funny how throughout time things have changed. So for example, I would never get upset with my kid for reading a book, but I remember reading lots of classic literature, you know, written 100 years ago or whatever, where moms would, or mother, you know, moms and dads would be wringing their hands over their little kids reading too much.
So, right? No, you read a lot of stuff from 100 years ago, and they were constantly, like, they would rip novels out of their hands.
Yeah.
And it was, like, and now we're, like, I'm confident in 30 years they'll be begging the children to watch movies.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's just, it's kind of funny. Everything is, you know, everything ebbs and flows, and there's always something new coming up, and we're kind of caught up in that trend, so it's, you know, it takes some time and thought and intention to kind of overcome it. But I like your idea about having a philosophy behind it, because you're right. That does just make it easier to commit, and it makes you feel better.
Yeah.
About your choices.
Yeah.
So Gretchen, I have to wrap up this segment, but we will be back in the next segment, and I want to continue talking about time and family time. So we'll be right back.
Hi everyone, Megan here. Just wanted to remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast in iTunes. That way, when a new one comes out, it'll just get sent automatically to your phone or your computer. To subscribe, just go to the iTunes store and search for The Kitchen Hour and subscribe there. Thanks.
Hi, I'm back with The Kitchen Hour. I'm here with Gretchen Rubin, and we are talking about happiness at home. Gretchen, of course, is the author of both The Happiness Project and the new book, Happier at Home. And I'm going to read the subtitle, Kiss More, Jump More, Abandon a Project, Read Samuel Johnson, and My Other Experiments in the Practice of Everyday Life. I love Abandon a Project. I haven't gotten to the point in the book yet where you abandon a project, but can you tell me a little bit about that?
Oh, yes. This I thought was my own private pathology, but it turns out that it's more widespread than I had thought.
Okay.
So when I, what I did for the year, I went around the house and was looking kind of shelf by shelf to see what we could get rid of, you know, anything we didn't use, didn't love, or didn't need. I was just trying to either recycle it or throw it away or give it away. And I found that there was this one class of possessions that I would call projects. Mm-hmm. So these were projects that usually me, but sometimes other people in my family, had started and then for some reason abandoned. Like, you know, you start something, you're going to build something or make something or create something or do something, and it ends up being more complicated than you thought or less fun than you thought or just too much work or there's too many moving parts or whatever. And so you sort of put it down midstream and then never pick it up again. But then there's this fantasy that, oh, of course we're going to finish building that blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And so you just leave it there. And so I found that these things, they cluttered up my shelves, but they also weighed on my conscience because I constantly felt this tug, like, you should finish this, you should do this. But then for whatever reason, I didn't really want to. And I've heard from so many people, it's like they have knitting projects or they're going to make a scrapbook from a trip that they took now 5 years ago, or they were going to learn how to make beer in their bathtub. And you sort of get part of the way into it deep enough that you feel like, oh, I can't just get, you know, I have this stuff or I put in this time or whatever. But the fact is you're not going to finish, you know, just realistically, you know, it's always this idea, I'll do it in my free time, but people just don't have that much free time. And when you do have free time, you're not like, now I'm going to finish making that album for the trip to France that I took 5 years ago. It just never is the right time for something. So I found that when I really was honest with myself and I'm like, I either really need to commit to finishing this and getting it done, or I need to abandon it then there was these things that really did kind of drag me down because I felt guilty about the fact that I hadn't finished them. They just went away, and it was such a relief. And I hear from people all the time where it's like, you know, just the relief of feeling like, okay, I do not have to finish needlepointing that pillow. I could just give it away or do whatever with it, figure out something else to do with it, and just get it out of your house.
I love that you brought up scrapbooking. I actually was a creative memories consultant for about 3 weeks right after having kids. Because somebody really sold me on this idea that it's not enough to album, you have to scrapbook. I mean, that's, you know, there's a difference. Like, you can stick your out photos and albums, you just scrapbook. So I bought all this stuff and then I moved it. We moved over the next 10 years. We probably moved 11 times. I moved that box of scrapbooking stuff 11 times and it always took up like a whole closet because it was this huge box. And I never scrapbooked after that first, like, because it took forever. I don't have nice handwriting. I'm not very artistic. You know, it just took forever. And I have a crap ton of pictures. I take so many pictures. So I'd have all these boxes of photos and I think, oh my God, I'm so behind. I'm never going to get an album, you know, done. And
so what do you do?
I finally just got rid of it all and decided, but it took me like 10 years to get rid of it and decide scrapbooking's not for me. And if I never make a scrapbook, that'll be okay. And it was like, wow, it really freed me up because now I can do something with those photos, like put them in a stupid album that I could have done, you know, 10 years ago that I never did. And it was great. It was so freeing, but it took me so long. I just had this idea of what I should be doing in my head.
Yeah, it's also this idea of one of my secrets of adulthood is don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're like, well, this fantasy of making the perfect scrapbook that's going to be this wonderful artistic memento.
Right. Kind that of will be passed down to generations.
So you don't even like print out your photos. Or
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's so. And the other thing that I've kind of noticed about that and other things I've abandoned along the way, I've gotten much better at abandoning since then, I will say. But is that the things that I really, if something is a project that I'm really into that I really want to do, I know that. And I don't even feel tempted to abandon it. Even if it's not time to do it right now, it's a totally different feeling. It doesn't weigh on me. It's like, oh, that's exciting. I'll do that someday. Maybe I can't get to it right now. But the feeling is completely different.
See, and I think that's a perfect example of this idea of mindfulness, because which I'm like the least mindful person in the world, but it's the key to happiness. Because part of it is like, if you're aware enough about it and you say to yourself, well, this is something I really, truly am excited about doing. I don't have to worry that I'm going to want to abandon it versus the thing that you do want to abandon. And then you act on that.
Right.
Then you're happier because your life and your stuff and your household reflects what you really want to do with your time and what's really important to you. But when you let those fantasies or like these ideas, like, well, I spend all this money on this scrapbooking, so I have to use it up. You know,
right.
or you know, it's not enough to make a photo album. It has to be this perfect photo album, and
right.
therefore have no photo album. But when you're really paying attention to what actually makes you excited, then it's much clearer what you should be doing. And I think that's really helpful is when you pay attention to what you're really excited about doing.
And I think sometimes, like you were saying, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. You know, the other thing that I kind of, just using the scrapbooking example again, or the album example, is I also wasn't even just thinking about now. I was like thinking of this imaginary 100 years in the future when, you know, my great, great, great grandchild was going to pull this album out and know our whole family history and blah, blah, blah. And then I thought, you know what? That probably is never going to happen, but I'm okay with that. I'm going to release that, you know, and that's not going to happen, but there'll be pictures of us somewhere. And so we won't be completely forgotten. And if there is some record of me, it'll probably be written and not, you know, photographs, and that's okay too.
Yeah. I think, and this is, I haven't really thought this through, but I've been thinking lately that whenever you justify doing something, thinking that like in 10 or 15 years, it's really going to pay off.
Right.
To me to be kind of dangerous. Like I need these people who did this big renovation on their house, and their idea was like, okay, well, this is going to be great because when our children have grandchildren, they're all going to want to come back and play. And I was like, but your children, you know, they're not even married yet, and they
right.
might live in London, or they might, I mean, so many things could happen. And really, I think they just wanted to do this renovation and wanted an excuse. And right. So they weren't really being honest. I mean, that was my reading of the situation about what their motivation was. They were justifying it for this other way. But then it also puts this weird pressure on their children. I don't know. It's like, or a friend of mine who was saying she was keeping all these business suits from the early start part of her career, saying that her daughter would want to wear them. I'm like, your daughter's not going to wear like 15-year-old business suits. I mean, right. Come on. Right. You know, that's just not, you know, but sort of pretending like everything is for the benefit of someone else, or people who make these huge collections thinking that, you know, their descendants are going to treasure these right. salt and pepper shaker collections or whatever. I mean, maybe they will, or maybe they won't. Do it for, because it's fun for you. But to justify things that you're doing on the basis that other people will want it or appreciate right. it seems kind of dangerous, because you can't control their reaction. Maybe they won't appreciate it. Now, if you do it because you love it, right. then it's great if they appreciate it, or it's not. Like, if you love making the scrapbooks, whether in 100 years your descendants were eagerly turning the pages wouldn't really matter to you. But if you forced yourself to do it kind of in this idea that one day they would be treasures, well, then if they just get, you know, stuck in a junk heap, then it was all sort of for nothing. So I always think it's good to think about, well, why are you doing what you're doing? And it, does it justify itself to you? Because if you're waiting for other people to appreciate it or be grateful, you can't always control what their reaction is going
to
be.
That's true. And I've known a couple of people who've done the whole, I'm hanging on to this for a future generation or something along those lines. And it's often a hoarding thing. So, you know, it's maybe not the kind of hoarding that's on TV with dead cats and stuff, but I mean, it's still, I think, is often rooted in scarcity or fear or something other than actually wanting to carry this forward. You know, it's not altruistic. Let's put it that way. So,
yeah. No, it's really worth thinking about, you know, like, is my grandchild going to really want to be playing with this dusty, dirty plastic telephone that's been in my basement for 30 years, you know?
Right. And then who are you burdening with that stuff, too? I mean, not that they're, I love handing things down. And so it's not like I'm anti-possessions or anti-hand-me-downs, but I think sometimes we think people will want the things that we want, that we have, because we want them to want them. Did that make sense, what I just said?
I know. I think that's really true. And I also think, like with something like toys, they're precious to us because we've, like, anything that I associate with my daughter's childhood becomes precious to me, like to a burdensome degree. Like, I, in the book, I write about how I had trouble throwing away a tube of Orajel because I was like, oh, Orajel, and they were teething.
It was so cute.
You know, sweet. But, you know, you can't keep everything that they touch. And the fact is that that tube is trash to anyone except for me. And because it's only precious because of the memories that I attach to it. And so that's also part of the thing with toys or clothes or whatever. You have to remember that they don't have that precious association with other people. And so, you know, it's better to like get them go, you know, pass them along to somebody who wants them right now rather than hold them back and then think that that will somehow stick to it. But one thing I found that really helped me with this is, for each of my daughters, I got a big plastic box, and for some reason we call them the memorandum boxes. That's what my daughters call them. And every once in a while, if something is particularly a precious memory, we put it in there. Very rarely. But it's like both of my daughters wore this mermaid costume. I mean, to death. The thing is just a shred. It's in rags. And I was like, I can't get rid of the mermaid costume, but I can't give it away because it's just like, it's nasty. Mm-hmm. So we put it in the memorandum box. And what I found is, like, if I keep one thing that's like the precious memory of a time, then everything else I can let go of and give away because I have the thing that is sort of the paradigmatic memory that can represent everything that I want to hold on to. Or sort of like, if you can keep one Polly Pocket, you can get rid of the rest of the Polly
Pocket. Right. Yeah. I like that.
Or like, I kept my daughter's favorite sippy cup. Mm-hmm. And then I was able to get rid of all the other plastic, you know, plates and cups and everything. Cause I was like, well, we have the precious sippy cup of that time. And so it freed me to pass along a lot of things that I otherwise was sort of hanging on to out of sentiment.
I love that. That in our family has happened sort of naturally because of all the handing down. Most of the stuff was really so beaten up by the time the last kid gets to it. But I have like the one sweatshirt that I feel like kind of just encapsulates all of my children when they were babies. It was something they all wore. You know, and so I can see each of them in it, and I have pictures of all of them in it. So to me, like, that is all I need. You know, I don't need to have whole box full of them, because that one shirt is just, it's that tactile thing that I really want to hang on to. Yeah, I like that. I like the one Polly Pocket can stand for all. Yes. Can stand for all Polly Pockets. Oh, that's fun. You know, and I think that, like you said, with the perfect, you know, being the enemy of the good, all of these things, I want to actually return really quick to what you said about you're the least mindful person in the world. That's what I wanted to bring up. So please expound on that. I want to hear why you say that.
You know, I'm just one of these people, you know, I'm very distracted. Like if you talk to me, if you call to me, I'll jump a foot. I get very lost in my own thoughts. You know, I walk down the street and don't notice people that I, you know, that I know, because I'm just sort of in space. my whole family, you know, it's a very good quality in many ways to have like a lot, like a very high focus. Mm-hmm. Like we can all really concentrate, but which is good. But on the other hand, like when you're concentrating on one thing, it's very hard for me to switch gears. And so if I do something like start to read the paper, it's very hard for me to be talking to my daughter or like going in and out of that. Like I'm sort of doing one thing or the other. And actually one of the things I had to do was really say to myself, you know, there's certain types of things I just can't do during family time, because if I want to be talking to my daughters, it'll just annoy me if I'm reading and they keep talking to me, even though I want to be talking to them. I'm like, I'm reading my book here.
So
for me, and I'm also a person who doesn't tune in that much to my emotions, I think. I'm a kind of some people are very aware of their, like my younger daughter is very aware and extremely articulate for a 7-year-old about her emotional states. I mean, I'm sometimes staggered by the complexity with which she describes a state that I recognize perfectly well as an adult. But for me, that comes harder. And so I really have to, like you were saying about how you felt about the two projects, like that for me, I would really have to make a very deliberate attempt to think that through. I kind of have to go through the steps to it. I'm not that aware of it. Unless I really ask myself questions, which is why I did these projects, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's funny. And I like that you said that, because I want to get into this in our next segment a little more, but, I think sometimes we, again, feel like there's a way that we should be as opposed to the way we are. So you're obviously very cerebral and you've got a lot going on in your brain. I mean, we know that's just from reading your thoughts and talking to you. What's that?
That's a nice way to put it. Thank you.
You're very welcome. See, now you can go around and just tell people that. You could say, I'm the most cerebral person in the world.
My husband maybe would characterize that differently, but I like your characterization.
But I think there's a difference between, I mean, there's people who are very physical. There's people who are very emotional. There's people who are very mental. And I think it's okay to be like your type, you know, and to not always have to be thinking about trying to be a different way. Although I think it is definitely worthwhile and valuable to strive to be more mindful, I think the problem is when you start to think there's something wrong with the way you are, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the central challenges of a happiness project is to accept yourself, but also expect more from yourself. Mm. And one of the things is, where are you pushing up against the natural limitations of your nature? And it's just futile and silly to think that you're going to go to the jazz club at midnight. And when is it really appropriate to say, I can ask more of myself in this situation. I can dig deep. I can step up. I should feel that this is something that is appropriate for me to strive for. Because I think you're right. On the one hand, you want to accept yourself and acknowledge the reality. And on the other hand, you don't want to settle and you don't want to not strive.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So I have to wrap up this segment, but we will be back in a few minutes. I really want to talk more about this idea of mindfulness and how it kind of relates to being distracted in time. I just find this all fascinating. So we'll be right back.
So I'm in my third week of the Kitchen Hour and I'm having so much fun. I hope you're enjoying the podcast and the blog posts. And I would love to hear what you'd like to see next on the Kitchen Hour, whether it's an idea for a blog post or a guest you'd love to have on the podcast. Please let me know. Send an email to megan@thekitchenhour.com or leave a comment after this post and let me know. Thanks.
Hi, Hi, welcome back to the Kitchen Hour. I'm here with Gretchen Rubin, author of Happier at Home, her brand new book, and also the New York Times bestselling The Happiness Project. And Gretchen also blogs at happiness hyphen or dash. I don't know. What do you say, Gretchen? Happiness-project.com. That's a mouthful. So nice to have you back, Gretchen. Oh. We were just talking about, we kind of were going on many tangents, which I love doing, but we were talking about this idea of mindfulness, and then we were also talking about distraction and kind of understanding who you are, if you're the kind of person who is very thoughtful or really is in tune with your emotions, or some people are very naturally in touch with their bodies.
Yeah.
And Gretchen was saying how a main focus of her book and her philosophy is that you can be who you are, but also be striving to just be, maybe to be just aware of other ways that you could be and ways that you can improve. Would you say that's?
Yeah.
Okay. But I wanted to bring up, you were mentioning that you get really annoyed when you're reading a book, say, and someone comes up and interrupts you. Yeah. And, that is one of the biggest reasons I started doing a nightly kitchen hour, because what I was finding was I didn't have a natural end to my workday. And so I was never, like, there was never a time when I wasn't annoyed when people talked to me. So it was like, here on the one hand, I had my family, who, of course, I love more than anything, and I want to spend time with, and I want to make them my priority, but my actions aren't meeting up with that, because I never shut it off. I never say, this is time that I'm going to spend. And I found that for myself, I have to have like a project, or I have to have like a set thing that I'm doing, that like a program I'm on to make it happen. So I'm wondering if you can kind of relate to that idea where you have to like very consciously and distinctively set aside time to not feel distracted.
Yes. And one of the resolutions that I follow is to give myself a quitting time. Because I think I have exactly the same situation as you do. And I think more and more of this is the experience of people. Is it used to be like 9 to 5 and you would leave your office and then it was like the end of the workday. But now it's like, because we have this cubicle in our pocket, we always could be working, or we should be working, or we might be working. And you don't have this feeling of leisure or being at rest, because there's always sort of this thing like, well, I could just, you know, jump in and do a little something or answer some emails. And so then when they're at home, they don't have a sense of repose, because it's not enough of a difference from their workday. And so what I do now is I give myself a quitting time, and it's different every day. I have no set schedule, which drives me crazy, but there it is. And I will say, like, after this point, it sounds like you do the same thing. Like, after this thing happens, then it's quitting time. And then I'm at leisure, and then I'm not going to work. I don't check my email again. I don't read for work. Like, I have all these different kind of categories of reading that I do, and I don't do work reading after that time, because I want to have a sense of being at rest. And one thing that I started, which has helped me immeasurably, and it's so silly, it's so tiny, it's laughable, but it actually made a very big difference, is I realized that because I was always kind of snapping in this very mean way to my husband and my daughters when they would interrupt me while I was thinking. And I realized even though I wanted to have family time, like I wanted them to come to my office and say hello to me or whatever. So why was I being mean to them when they came? And I realized it was because of this jarring quality of being dragged out of my concentration. And like, I just snap every time that happens. It's very hard for me. So what I did, and I couldn't believe how quickly everybody adopted this habit, I said, knock on my office door and wait for me to tell you to come in. And because having that knock gave me that transition second that I needed to kind of put down my mental thoughts and shift gears, and so that I could respond in a nice way. Because I want to say like, oh, I'm so happy to see you, I'm so glad you're home from school or whatever. But I need that knock. I need that minute, not even a minute, a second to transition.
And
you might think, well, somebody who has had better, a mother who enforced better manners would have taught a child a long time ago to knock before they come into a closed room. But it never occurred to me. Like, I didn't care. It's not like I have any, it's not about privacy or anything like that.
Right.
It was more about creating a transition.
That's funny, because when would you have taught them to knock? Because you were always so busy. Like, you're always so busily concentrating. Like, my kids will sneak into my office. I literally won't even know they're there. And they tap me on the shoulder. I'm like, what?
You know? So, well, try the knock because it's I found that that was helpful to me. The fact that it's hard to disengage from working, it's a challenge for people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I do see that with, and I struggle with it sometimes too, because, you know, there is such a thing as this, the work world has changed, and I've benefited from that immensely. I mean, I can work whenever I want. I can work night times if I missed out on during the day. If I didn't feel like working early in the day, I can work later. But it's kind of a dangerous trap that we walk into with that flexibility, because it's very, like you said, there's always something you could be doing. And even when you worked 50 hours, there's always something more you could be doing. And how much more successful can I get if I X, Y, Z? And how much more, you know, so... I like that idea of,
and the more you like your work too, the more you kind of want to be doing it. And so it can get in the way of other things that are just as important or more important, but sort of aren't urgent in the same way or aren't as kind of clearly on a to-do list. Like hang out and do a puzzle isn't on the to-do list the way answer 5 emails is, but over the long run, it's important. And so you have to, I completely agree with what you said about like, it has to go on the schedule or it has to be, you know, locked in. I'm the same way. If it's not on the schedule, it just doesn't happen. It has to go on the schedule in some way.
Right. And you know, another thing I was thinking of when you were talking about kind of being lost in thought and being interrupted and how jarring that is. One thing I've started doing, and it's much easier to do when it's nice out, is I'll be doing something like the dishes or whatever, just some mindless task. And suddenly I'm really deep in thought. And at that point, if anyone comes up and talks to me, I will be really unreasonably upset. So I go outside or go for a walk because I feel like if I can give myself 5 minutes out of the house to like think through whatever it is I'm thinking through, then I'll come back and be like, okay, now I can be normal again or present again. But when you're kind of locked in, it's really hard to shut that off. It's really hard to get out of that.
It's interesting that you say that because I've been thinking a lot about exercise and why people exercise in certain ways and other ways. And it's interesting about exercise. And again, this is about knowing yourself. For some people, one of the attractions of exercise is that it's social. And for some people, the attraction of exercise is that it's solitary. And I've heard from a lot of people, like people with young children and stuff, or who work in like really like people intensive offices, that they really like going for a run or like, you know, having their earphones on, even at the gym where they're not actually physically alone, but no one's talking to them or engaging with them. And so I think you're right. Like sometimes that is a way to get that solitude because you're literally out the door and going. And I know a lot of people, a friend of mine, she takes incredibly long showers and her husband was like, what's up with these incredibly long showers? And she's like, it's the only time that people don't, you know, come and tug at me and ask me questions and where's this and where's that? And what are we going to, you know? And so she just found that she was taking longer and longer showers because she needed that solitude and that time just to be alone with her thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
So you're right. I mean, sometimes you just have to physically remove yourself in order to get that.
You know, it's funny that you're talking about earlier, you said, I think it was in the last segment that you were the least mindful person in the world. And it reminded me of something that I read in your book that, and I can't remember where it was, maybe in the intro, I don't remember now, but you were having a conversation with somebody who was trying to talk you into meditating.
Oh, yeah.
And you were basically like, look, not going to happen. So, meditation is, again, one of those things where I feel like I should want to do it.
Yeah.
I feel like what's wrong with me that I don't like it. Yeah. The only kinds of meditation I've ever really liked have been the kinds where you're doing other things, which isn't really meditation. I mean, like, you know, walking meditation, but then are you really meditating? No, you're walking. I mean, it is, but it isn't. And so I think I finally come to peace with the fact that I don't need that. I don't need to do that to calm my brain or turn off the distraction or whatever. That's not the tool for me.
Yeah.
And that's okay. And I wonder, like, have you tried meditation and just decided it wasn't? Did you kind of run up against that same...
I mean, I have to say, like, within the framework of my books, you'd think I really ought to try it so I can try it and, like, give it a good fair try.
Right.
But I have to admit, like, it holds no attraction to me. I mean, like, the idea of it just seems to me not to be the kind of thing that would be. Like, I love going for walks, like, long meditative walks. I would, the idea, like, if somebody said, go for a 20-minute walk. I would think that would be great. But sit in a room for 20 minutes, just sitting there, it just is so not interesting to me to try that I just thought, you know what, I just have to admit to myself that it's just not right for me.
Right.
If it's so not something that catches my interest, because it's not, because other things I hear about, I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm going to do that right away. Like somebody said, I'm writing a novel in a month. I'm like, oh my gosh, I want to write a novel in a month too. You know, off I go and write a novel in a month. So it's not like I never want to do anything.
Right.
Meditation is just at the bottom of
It's just at the bottom of your list. Well, you know, it's interesting. I've read tons of books about like mindfulness meditation, and I agree with the book. Like, I when they talk about the kind of the philosophy and you know, kind of just being aware and turning off sort of these signals that you've always got kind of bouncing all around your head. I'm like, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I can get behind all that. Sure. Yeah. But meditation is not the tool for me. Like sitting on a, you know, all I can think about is, oh, I'm so uncomfortable. Oh, you know, what am I going to have for dinner? And I think I've finally got to the point where it's like, that's okay. You know, I've got other, there's other tools available to me. And if that tool works for somebody else, yes. Yay for them.
Absolutely. Yes.
But it's not the path to mindfulness for me, whatever that path might look like, that ain't it. And sometimes when things, you know, and I think sometimes you look at someone like, maybe a dancer or a painter. I mean, maybe that's their tool, or there's just different ways of finding that place. So, I was actually really relieved to read that.
Because, oh, that's good.
Because honestly, I think people think that thoughtful people all do the same things. Do you know what I mean? Like, if this person is thoughtful and they're self-improving, they're doing X, Y, and Z because that's what everybody who's into self-improvement is doing. And that's just not true.
No, people are, it's funny because on the one hand, I think people are more alike than they think, but then I also think people are less alike than they think, which is totally contradictory, but somehow seems true to me.
Well, I like in some ways and maybe not in others.
Yeah. But like one thing that has really struck me kind of along the lines of what you're saying is I have found just in myself and then also whenever I talk to people about it, it's very clear that this is something that resonates with a lot of people, is that if you're trying to give something up, you're trying to restrain yourself in some way about something. So like, let's say you're trying to eat more healthfully, like the most common thing. Some people do much better abstaining altogether. Like mm-hmm. That's somebody like me, where I am much better off just saying, I don't ever have that. And then I just give it up. And that's not hard for me to do. And then there's some people who I call moderators, and they do better when they feel like they can have it sometimes, or they can have a little bit, or, you know, from time to time, it's okay. Because if you tell them they're going to abstain, then they get very panicky and rebellious, and they want to just go out and like do it over and over again, or indulge over and over again to sort of prove their freedom.
Right.
It's really helpful to know yourself and whether you're an abstainer or a moderator, because clearly it makes a big difference. And so, but the funny thing is that people are really judgmental. Like you say, people assume like, well, all thoughtful people do this the same way. And so as an abstainer, moderators are constantly castigating me for abstaining and saying, you're too rigid, you're going to fall off the boat, you should indulge time to time, follow the 80-20 rule, this is not healthy. And as an abstainer, I say to moderators, I'm like, why do you keep breaking your own rules? Right. You know, you can't, why are you wasting your time, like, debating and justifying and figure out today, tomorrow, whatever. And I think it's just like some people do better in some way and some people do better the other way, but it's really helpful to know what's actually true for you, because
right.
You really want to, like, eat less sugar or something like that. Are you better off saying, I'm not going to eat dessert, like, for the foreseeable future, I'm just not going to eat it. Or are you better saying like, well, I can have dessert every couple of weeks.
Right.
And
yeah, that's funny.
People are less alike than they think.
I think that I'm a moderator in practice, but maybe an abstainer in, I'm going to give you a third category, Gretchen, but I think that, I'm an abstainer in practice, but a moderator in, mentally. So, okay, so here's where I'm going with this. I gave up soda a few years ago. Like, I totally gave up. I had a really horrible Mountain Dew addiction. Like, I was drinking, like, 40 ounces of Mountain Dew a day. It was really awful. And I finally just had to make myself completely give it up. But, you know, actually, now that I think about it, I'm a moderator. I still have Coke every now and then. So I just scratch all of what I just said. I think I'm a moderator. But I think that one of the things that struck me when you said, oh, you know, you're going to fall off the wagon, you have to, like, give yourself a break, blah, blah, blah. I think a lot of that comes from we live in this sort of media world where we think in sound bites. So like, how many times have you read in a magazine, if you want your fitness plan to stick, you know, give yourself days off. Or if you want your eating plan to work, you have to do X, Y, and Z. And you read something so many times, you just kind of start to believe it.
Yes.
Generally, you also believe the one that you agree with more. Yes. That's the one that sticks. So,
I mean, I think people sort of even forget that it's an option. You know,
right.
You could just say, I'm just not going to do it.
Right.
And I think also, you know, something about abstaining is that, sometimes even if you're not going to abstain forever, like abstaining briefly kind of shows you, reveals to you your habits or it shows you like what else you could be doing. Like for, so something for like television, you know, maybe somebody would want to kind of, who was watching a lot of TV and felt like they're watching too much might say, okay, I'm not going to watch any TV at all for a month, just so I'm like back in touch with what's life like without TV, even though realistically, I don't expect that I would give it up forever. So
right.
You sort of do temporary abstaining, not thinking that they would do it ever, but it's funny because especially with like food stuff, I find that for abstainers, they just waste so much time and energy, like trying to be moderate. Like,
trying to moderate it.
If I get a cookie, sometimes do I get it today? Do I get it tomorrow?
Right. When is the, what's
I'm
the rule?
Sick, deserve it. I'm a guest. Somebody made these specially for me. Like there's all these exceptions and loopholes and justifications and it's just like, oh my gosh, it's not worth it.
Right.
And give it up and just be done and move on. And I just find that much, much easier. But I know that some moderators would really, really rebel against a bright line rule like that.
You know, it's funny, like when you just mentioned the abstaining temporarily, I think maybe that's kind of what I was getting to with the giving up soda. I had to like make myself completely stop. And by doing, I mean, I had to like not have it at all for a year. I mean, it was, you know, really intense. And then after that, I was like, eh, okay, I can go back. I mean, I don't need it anymore. I've moved on to some other obsession, but, that
like,
makes
it
work.
Sort of broken its hold over you. And so you can have it from time to time without going back into the, you know.
And I rebel too. I'm a rebellious person, but I can do anything for a short amount of time. So it's like, I won't rebel if it's 2 weeks or a month. You know, if I create a rule for myself, it's only when it's been dragging on for a while that I, you know, that I'm like, oh, why am I doing this anymore? But, you know, hopefully by that point, you've just forgotten what it was you were, what it was you were so into.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm really sorry to have to wrap up with you, Gretchen. This has been so fun and I really appreciate you coming in and talking with me. Again, the book is Happier at Home, Kiss More, Jump More, Abandon a Project, Read Samuel Johnson, and My Other Experiments in the Practice of Everyday Life by Gretchen Rubin. And you can find her online at happiness-project.com. Gretchen, thanks so much.
Oh, thanks. It was so much fun talking to you.
Thanks so much for spending your kitchen hour with Gretchen Rubin and I this week in this episode of the Kitchen Hour podcast. If you want links to Gretchen's blog or either of her books, just check out the show notes at thekitchenhour.com/episode 3.